Yeah.
Just have an O in your one.
Okay, great. So, I'll just since we're running a little late, I'll just be very brief. So we're lucky to have Yanev here. He's in town after NURBS, a member of Yonatan's lab. And so we're looking forward to your talk.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my last presentation, so I'm hoping my throat will still hold up until the end. So hi, nice to meet you. I'm Yaniv. As David said, I'm a PhD student working on interpretability in Yonatan's lab. And today I want to tell you a little bit about my interpretability research that has focused on the paradigm of circuit analysis so far. Never mind. And by the end of the presentation, I hope to convince you in several things. First, and I guess that's moot given that this is an interpretability lab, is that interpretability is cool and useful. Second, I want to convey that investigating model circuits is a useful paradigm of interpretability, and that can be useful for multiple targets. And lastly, I hope to convince you that to make it really useful in, let's say, frontier tasks, we have to think about how to scale it further. Feel free to stop me at any point for questions, either technical or abstract. If I'll want to go up ahead, I'll just cut it out and we'll continue later. So I'll skip this slide since we're here. So in my opinion, interpretability is quite useful for two main aspects. The first one being scientific insights, both on the models themselves and on the domains which are modeled by the models, either language, vision, biology, whatever. Second, I think interpretability is great for fixing problems in models, much like you probably know very well many such problems that exist. And today I'll present two works, each tackling slash discussing one of these directions, and hopefully we'll have time to also mention a work in progress that tries to take this paradigm and scale it further to more complex problems. Cool. So before we start with the studies themselves, let's just go do a quick overthrow of what circuit analysis is to make sure we're on the same page. So when I say so when we look at what models do, the classical approach most people use is look at them as a black box that receives some sort of input and outputs some sort of output. Let me know if I'm like blocking your way or something. I'll try to slide throughout. And a more useful prism is looking at them as a sort of sequence of layers, a sequence of blocks, modules, whatever, which is pretty equivalent to observing a model, a neural network, as a computational graph. A computational graph whose nodes are any sort of representation that goes on within the model. For example, the outputs of attention heads or MLPs or specific MLP neurons. And the edges are defined by the architecture of the network. And the paradigm of circuit analysis basically states that one approach to investigate these models and how they work is to understand subgraphs of these computational graphs. And this includes a first step of localizing a subgraph that is important to a specific behavior. For example, a running example in the first part will be this arithmetic prompt made out of two operands. And the second step of this paradigm is to interpret said subgraph and understand how it works. Now, we won't go into the first part too much, but I'll just say that it's usually comprised of any technique that gives each node or each edge some sort of importance score of how important it is to the specific behavior we're analyzing, and then pruning the unimportant ones to get, hopefully, a sparse subgraph. Cool. Great. So going into the first work, we looked at the first question I presented before, which is model insights or scientific insights. How do these models do things? And we tried to tackle an well-researched question, which probably has thousands of paper written on it and has no single definitive answer. How much do models generalize versus memorize their training distributions? And we try to attack this through a prism of arithmetic questions, which is a good setting because arithmetic questions can either be solved by a robust algorithm, much like the one you probably learned in the first grade, or by memorizing an entire training distribution up to some extent. For example, memorizing all exercises until 1,000. And specifically, we look at arithmetic prompts made out of four positions, operand, operator, operand, equal sign. Very, very simple. And the way we attack this is using the circuit analysis paradigm, where we first try to localize a specific subcircuit and then try to explain how it works, hoping to either find evidence for memorization or for some sort of robust algorithm. Cool. So again, keeping the entire localization process rather as a black box, we find the importance score for each node in our computational graph, where the nodes we look into are attention heads and entire MLPs at each position, each of the four positions. And I want to direct you to the results you see here basically state that there's a very sparse subset of attention heads which have any importance to the prompt, and two groups of MLPs important to arithmetic prompts. Early MLPs that are important across all positions but the last one, and the last half of the MLPs which are important in the last position. Stating that we can prune all of the other components from the graph, ablate their values in a fourth pass, and still get pretty much the same results. Now, our point was to investigate what parts of the model actually generate the answer, so we try to
Yeah,
localize
Trey,
this even further.
are you going to talk
Yes.
about your setting more, or can I ask just a
Go ahead.
clarifying question? So this is a model that you trained just to do this task, or you
No,
taught
okay.
a lot
This
about it?
we tried this on a set of general models of several scales from 1 billion to 70 billion. We didn't fine-tune any of them. Personally, I think that to investigate specific behaviors and actually get an unaffected answer, fine-tuning is something we should generally avoid, like unless you have to
Unless
for
that's
some
what you're
reason.
saying, yeah.
Cool. So, yes.
Can you imagine just you said it's like a black box, but
Yeah, so the question was which localization method we used. Here it was activation patching. You basically take a component, replace its activation with a counterfactual activation, and try to see how much it affects the result. Cool.
layer by layer, MLP by MLP, one single layer.
Yes, MLP by MLP or attention head by attention head,
One
layer by layer,
attention head.
position by position. Yes. I present here only the results for the attention head in the last position because the other positions are irrelevant for this. Like they're just no attention heads are important to give output in any of the other positions. Cool. So as I said, we want to identify what are the components within this subset that actually have some role in generating the correct answer. So we train a probe on the representation of at each layer and each position, trying to extract the correct answer, meaning we have a specific Like, for example, for a specific layer and specific position, we have many representations for many prompts, and we're trying to extract from this vector representation, from this representation vector, the correct answer for that prompt. And showing the test accuracy of these many linear probes that we train, we see a very clear pattern where all of these answers are only extractable at the last position after some middle layer. Now, looking at the important components that match this description, we see that the only ones are the MLPs in those in the last position in those layers. So we ask the further question on, let's zoom into them and understand how they work. Yes, Karen.
Bigger embedding the correct answer. Is it for those pieces that do get the correct answer, or is it also the piece where you get a false answer?
So the prompts we analyze are upfront only the ones that are that the model gets correctly. And the accuracy level of the models we use is roughly 90% because to localize a behavior properly, you need it to exist. You need the model to be good at it.
The rectangle is in the bands 20, 30, and in the left one,
Well,
the rectangle in the
it's more like 15 to 30, and
okay. But
it's
here
not
is
exact.
using.
Well, the important layers here are the importance of the MLPs here is lower. And I mean that's just we still had to keep them in like in the circuit to have good performance. But like just looking at which components exist in the layers, it's only these ones. The MLPs in the other positions are unimportant,
Is zero
and there
to
are no attention heads in these positions.
0 to 10,
No, sorry,
what layer?
this is zero, this is last. So 15 to the last to 30. Cool. So zooming in on these MLPs, just as a reminder on how MLPs are defined, we have the output of the MLP is basically a linear combination of all of the MLP neurons, where what we define as a neuron is the activation, a single scalar dimension in the hidden representation of the MLP, which is multiplied by some row vector in the output matrix, the little blue rectangles you see there. And basically, what the output vector states for a neuron is what does this neuron write to the output of the MLP? What is encoded in that vector? And the activation states how much this value is written. And basically, we want to further zoom onto these MLPs and look at the individual importance of each neuron in these layers. So again, we do localization this time on each neuron activation, and we search for important neurons. Looking at a random layer at llama 3, 8 billion, we see a very sparse activation where the y-axis value here is the importance of each neuron. We see that there are very few neurons which have significantly over zero activation value. And we th this is nice because we can focus on them and try to understand what do they do. Now, we tried various approaches, but the one that eventually worked and gave us some hints was looking at the activation of each neuron as a function of the input, meaning we can look at the value each neuron at how much it fires. As a function of both operands, operand one and operand two. Now, because it's a function with two variables, we can just plot it as a 2D map, which is pretty nice. So, looking at the activation map of some random neuron, we see a pretty cool pattern. A very strong diagonal. Now, when looking at the activation patterns of other neurons, we also see similar patterns that we can give titles to. I'm not sure if you see this, but there is a very weak line here where the first operand is equal to the second operand. Here we have lines at periodic patterns whenever, well, we'll see it later. And another pattern which fires a neuron, which, for example, fires when a single operand is higher than some value. Now, of course, these patterns aren't perfect. This isn't binary here. There are various holes in this diagonal, but still, there's some sort of signal here. So, looking at what each of these neurons, not only on what it activates and also on what it does, we can look at another neuron here, for example, where we have again the running example subtraction prompt, and we see a neuron that is important for this prompt, and it has a activation pattern which we can label as this neuron fires when the result should be between 150 and 180. How do we create this label? Just by looking at this diagonal. And we can see by and analyzing its corresponding value vector, which I've mentioned before, that this neuron also embeds within its value vector some of the tokens which are in this range. Not all of them, but most of them. Looking at another neuron, we see again a similar pattern. I don't want to go into this due to lack of time. But generally, we see an interesting behavior. Each of these neurons responds on some input pattern that applies for the input prompt and corresponds both the correct answer by a little bit and also other answers which relate to this prompt, to this pattern, sorry. Now, you can think of this as like a Venn diagram with many, many circles, where at the center of it, promoted the most or by the most neurons, is the correct answer. We label this as our bag of heuristics hypothesis because each neuron acts as sort of heuristic, firing on an input pattern and promoting some sort of output, corresponding output. And only the combination of all of these heuristics promotes the correct answer enough to generate it. Any questions on so far? Oh, I have questions in the chat which I missed. Oh, Alex asked, how are these neurons identified? Sorry, I missed this question. The answer is by the same localization techniques I didn't go into before, activation patching or attribution patching. I can like talk about more later. Cool.
I have a question. So,
Yeah.
like, let's say you pick a random neuron that wasn't one of the ones that had high importance. Like, what kind of pattern would you expect? Just like random.
So we looked at them, yeah. If you draw out their patterns as a function of the input, like input arithmetic operands, it's just noisy or zero, near zero across everything, or like nothing very indicative.
I guess another question, probably we'll talk about it later, but like, will these patterns have like hierarchical structure? For example, if you looked at the patterns from the previous layer, like would they relate to the patterns that we found in the later layer?
So this is a very cool question. Unfortunately, due to this complexity of like comparing many, many patterns from previous layers and many patterns, and like it becomes way more difficult to do this and I'll throw like a single sentence on this later. And like one of the works by Anthropic, the attribution graphs, they also showed its usage on arithmetic prompts. And there they showed some sort of way to update this and like find also connections between different let's say patterns or neurons. You could also, for example, look at edges of the computational graph to find which edges have more weight, but we didn't want to go into that. Yeah, it will tell you like, okay, this affects that, but not why or how. You'll have to understand that by yourself. Cool. So far it's been a nice manual process. I won't go to. Which, like, an individual one or just.
Just be quiet and go with the example.
So you have the activation pattern of an individual neuron here, which basically means. Each pixel here states how much does this neuron activate for a specific input prompt. For example, this pixel, the blue one here, states how much does this neuron fire for the input prompt? 180, I don't know, and plus, sorry, minus 5. For example, like 180 is the y-axis and 5 is the x-axis value. And minus because this is a pattern for the subtraction operator. Yeah. But again, like we can go deeper into that later. So following this manual hypothesis creation, we want to validate it. And to do that, we need to somehow classify each neuron to its heuristic type. So to do this, we manually create many possible heuristic types based on the things we see that happen in neurons, where we end up with six heuristic types. Each of them can get hyperparameters. For example, one of the operands should be in some range, so the operand switches, and also the range itself switches. We take many values of these of this range, and then we run some matching algorithm to compare to match each neuron based on its activation pattern to the relevant heuristic types that correspond to it. Again, I don't want to go too deep into how we do this, and by doing this, we can show that we can take a specific prompt. We know which heuristics should apply to it because we see the operands. And if we choose specifically very few neurons that apply to that implement these heuristics and remove them from the model, even if they don't directly affect this prompt, in total, they will create a very rapid decrease in performance for this prompt. And we average this, of course, over many, many prompts. We see that we can ablate as few as five neurons per layer to completely destroy the model's accuracy. And we compare this to just picking the same number of neurons randomly, which requires way more neurons to lead to a similar ablation. And we pick like random heuristic neurons, not just random unrelated neurons. And this happens across operators and across models. And we run some more validations, but if you're interested, like let's talk about it later. I think some implications we can take from this work. Have time until one, right?
Yep, keep on going.
Yeah.
I'm just the only reason I'm worried is my computer is about to run out of batteries and I'm recording. So I might have to run out to get my
So,
Okay.
if that mean that with only 20 neurons, you can reduce the accuracy by 50% with only 20 neurons?
You mean of this? Like even you need even less than the, well, yeah, I mean it's per layer, so with
No,
removal of like I'm
I
not sure
mean
what this number is,
the
like
random ablation. With only 20 neurons, you were able to reduce the accuracy almost to zero.
yes, I should mention that
Wow.
there are a total of like 1% arithmetic neurons in each layer. So
So
that's like a
20,
hundred, that's
20.
like a hundred, that's like 100 neurons per layer. So randomly choosing 20 of them is still might get you like neurons that might be relevant for that.
Natalie, it's 20 per layer.
Yeah,
So in
20
total,
per.
okay. It's many more.
Yeah. I
So
mean,
a few hundred.
But how like
let's
how
maybe
the
talk about it
same.
later because I don't want to focus deep into this. Cool. So first of all, to answer our question that we started out with, is this an algorithm or is this memorization? Personally, I think it's a bit of both. It's like a set of many memorized rules, which is a bit of an annoying answer, I know, but bear with me. Some people I talked with just said, oh, this is just an algorithm, just not one we use. And we found that many of the like that the errors these models make on arithmetic prompts can be majorly attributed to failures in like heuristics, to incomplete heuristics. As you remember before, you saw the blue diagonal, but it wasn't perfect. It wasn't binary, like high firing in this range and zero everywhere else. It was like there were holes in it. So these incompletions, exactly, we found that to be the main cause for arithmetic failures. And this also has implications for longer horizon computations, where if you take a chain of thought and break it down to many steps of arithmetic computations in between, each of them it eventually has some sort of out needs to output some arithmetic number. And at that point, when these heuristics take place, they might fail, causing failures even in chain of thought settings, which we didn't investigate here, but some students dealt with in a future project in a course. Cool. Any questions generally on this?
So, incomplete heuristics, if it could work, let's say, would that sort of imply any sort of like hierarchical heuristic where, technically speaking, it could be reduced or moved to a further form or something like that?
What do you mean by, like, how would you connect hierarchy to this?
Like, as in, or like whether whatever heuristic one might have, it could have been reduced in even like smaller condition, which would have been considered incomplete, but it's probably just another heuristic.
I guess so. I know I had this like idea of trying to edit the model such that the heuristics will be complete and measuring how will it affect and increase the accuracy. I wasn't sure how to do that given that like editing is pretty difficult and noisy. Yeah, in short answer, I don't know. Cool. So the Oops, sorry. Okay, these are a bit long. I'll go over the questions, I think, later if we'll have time. Cool. So the downside of this was that we had to do a lot of manual interpretation work here. Also looking at patterns and activation maps of neurons. Generating the heuristic types, like defining them ourselves, it's pretty hard. And generally, the entire part of second part of circuit analysis, the interpretation, is hard, even for such a simple task. So we can further ask, within this paradigm, can circuit analysis still be useful even if we leave out the part of manual interpretation and just try to learn something from the circuits themselves, from their structure.
Oh, related to this, there was an online question. Darshana asked, to what extent can we predict what computations the model will make a mistake on based on what you found?
So we dive into that deeper in the paper. We build some hypothesis on what might lead to errors, and thus can we localize a possible problematic heuristics. We didn't get to a perfect pre-hoc prediction, but like we tried to validate several hypotheses, one being like, oh, you might have like just lack of a lower number of heuristics for specific prompts, that for incorrect prompts that wasn't the case. They might have enough heuristics that apply to them, but not enough neurons that implement them. That also wasn't the case. Generally, again, it's sort of the annoying answer of this is sort of spread out. So we weren't able to make a perfect prediction.
You weren't able to
Well,
connect this.
you might be able to, we didn't.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. So this question brings us to the second work, where we try to actually fix a problem in models based on findings, even without fully understanding or fully reverse engineering circuits. Specifically, we look at VLMs. Where VLMs in this context, just to make it clear, are models comprised of a language decoder that can take text only, but is also trained to receive as input visual embedding of tokens, visual tokens from an image, a video, several images, whatever. Now, these models have a very peculiar phenomena or problem, depends how you define it, where they perform better on prompts that are purely textual versus the same prompts, sort of the same prompts, where the same question is asked on a visual input. For example, over this slide, we'll look a lot on this image and this prompt of object counting, where we have the question of how many bananas are in an image or in a sequence that is equivalent to this image. We look at, there are also other tasks we define, generate data sets for, and investigate, but this phenomena has been widely shown across a lot of question domains, simple ones, complex ones, what have you. There's a paper called IsoBench from Caltech that deals with it, among other things. Yeah. So, what we said, we asked, can we un better understand this difference in performance from a mechanistic perspective? And more specifically, can we identify a difference in the computational pathways, i.e., the important components, the model circuits that are responsible for each of these behaviors? And we start by identifying for each of the variants, for each prompt, we have two variants, and for each of them, we identify the set of important components that is sufficient to answer it. Just as we did before with attribution patching this time.
Is
Now,
that the work that
yeah.
was it the
Yes, we presented it a week ago. So sorry if you've been in the workshop and you're hearing this twice. Yeah, David, I think might have heard it. Cool. Yeah, so the first step, we try to do a very simple structural analysis of whether the computational pathways are the same thing. Meaning, we look at the language circuit and visual circuit, basically two sets of components defined by their position, layer, and component index, i.e., MLP neuron or attention head index. And we look at their overlap, just how much do they intersect. And specifically, to make our results more fine-grained, we are based on a definition from earlier work, which splits up these prompts to three parts: the data part, which is either the image or the sequence; the query or question part, which is the task asked on, which is exactly the same between the variants; and the last generation position, in which the answer is actually generated. Again, the answer here is also still a single token because of circuit analysis limitations. And the three groups are separated by position. It's position aligned. Cool. So to look at the results of this overlap analysis, we see that in the data positions and in the query positions, we have relatively low overlap. In the generation position, it's quite higher, which makes sense since you have like the components at that position, their sole role is to generate the answer, right? So if the answer is the same between the two prompts and it's the same token, you would guess that it would be exactly the same components, which is still surprising that the IOU is only 0.6 and not even higher. And these results happen across models. Now, supposedly this says, okay, we have very different components that process these two modalities, but structure is only half the story because of two problems in analyzing neurons: redundancy and polysemanticity. The same neuron in both modalities can have a s different functional role because of polysemanticity, and different neurons can have the same functional role because of redundancy. This has been shown to happen. And to understand this better, we want to look beyond structure and also analyze functional equivalence. So to do this, to understand if a component in the textual circuit does the same thing as a different component in the visual circuit, we take We split up our circuit again to the three groups based on position. We take one of the groups, for example, the query components, and replace it with the query components from the different modality. We do a cross-modality patching process here. And given this circuit, this edited group of components, we basically ask how much does the result change compared to before. And from an intuition that if it doesn't change much, then the query visual components do the same thing as the query textual components. And of course, we do the opposite as well, and we do this across all three groups. The results, this time I'm showing them in reverse order. For the generation components, show extremely high interchange faithfulness, same role, basically the same role for the slightly different sets of components, indeed indicating a redundancy there. Another interesting finding is that the query components, for example, despite being v much more different in structural overlap, have high functional equivalence, indicating a very similar role. Unlike, which is like shows even more redundancy here. But the more interesting results here is that in the data components, the functional equivalence is super low, indicating that if there's a difference in computational pathways and the function of the groups, it's in these positions. And we need to look deeper into that. This, of course, happens across models. Now, this brings us to the question of if the components in the data positions act differently and are the major contributor to the difference in performance or processing, let's understand why, like what happens there, or how can we fix it? So throwing away the notion of circuits aside, like we're looking at the full models now, we look at the data positions and at each layer separately. We basically ask the question of how similar are the representations between a visual variant and its textual equivalent. We measure this by a form of cosine similarity, where we look for each visual token, which textual token matches it the most, and we average this similarity measure across all tokens to get a single number per layer. This single number indicates how similar are the whole of the visual representation to the whole of the textual representation. If we look at the results, we see that despite the model being trained to align visual components early on to the textual representation and process them together, we see an interesting upwards trend here. Starting from rather low similarity across all tasks, each line here represents a task, and slightly going up. This pattern is different in models, but like between models, but generally repeats itself.
Sorry.
And yeah.
Just a quick question about cosine similarity, because the number of tokens are different between images when you
Right.
put a
Yeah.
sentence, right?
Yeah.
How do you compute cosine similarity in this?
So, as I said, for each visual token, we search for the most similar textual token from, you would say, if you have an image patch of a dog, you probably want to search for the textual token that says dog, hoping that they would be the most similar, right? It might not be because the presentations in visual patches are distributed, but that's a whole other story. But generally, we look for the maximal and then average across all tokens. Cool. Yeah, so basically, what we see is that the visual tokens, as the processing proceeds in the model, become more and more similar to the textual equivalence, right? Now, this is a pattern that has been also shown in a parallel work called the semantic hub hypothesis, which I like very much, and you should have a read. Which basically states that if you have a multi-model model, which has a majority modality, usually it's English language. Sometimes it can have usually it's English language. So if you have another modality, vision, audio, whatever, and other languages, they slowly converge in similarity to the text to the major textual representation as the model progresses. Now, we basically say this to ask, okay, if The textual models perform better than the visual token than the visual sorry, if the text if the performance of the VLMs on the textual prompts is better than on the visual prompts. And the major difference is in these representations. And the representations of the visual tokens at these layers are the most similar to the textual representations. What will happen if we just plug them back into the model rather early here and let the model think these are textual representations? Will this activate the textual pathways more than the visual ones? And this basically is a technique called backpatching, was shown to be used in various use cases. And basically, this simple fix on the cost of a single forward pass bridges roughly a third of the performance gap, which is as low as 5% in some tests and as high as 20% in others. Now, this isn't a perfect solution, merely like a sort of a PO. We treat this as a POC to show that you can actually use circuit analysis to fix a problem. but I think this is like a cool result. We also do a control to make sure that it wasn't the extra compute that gave them all more time to process this these representations that improved the performance by testing what happens if you backpatch textual representations. The answer is that it doesn't help much. And that's it on this.
I see this. I see lots of mystified. Okay, go ahead and ask your question.
I just feel like, okay, I guess the question here is like, how does the model actually knows to process, like, because an earlier layer, probably the model only knows how to process the earlier layer token. It seems like there's
You're
different
asking
dist
how does this not throw them all out of distribution?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a good question. I'm slightly lying to you in this beautiful line from the end to beginning here. In reality, we have to backpatch somewhere to around layer 5 to remain rather enough in distribution. When like after the model received and processed its tokens and he know and it knows how to like process tokens. It like we tried a systematic approach of all from all layers to all other layers, and we found that this rather correlates in almost the latest layers to roughly like here, this area, 5 to 10.
I see.
But good question.
Technical question.
Yeah.
How did you measure no image? Can you insert, did
What
you
do
insert black image? Did you insert
you mean no image?
when you compared without image
In
versus
the control,
no, in comparison to the text.
Yes.
Similarities between processing images or processing text. It's not processing images to none.
yeah. You mean like,
Is that what you're asking?
you mean dissimilarity?
Yes.
So,
So
yeah.
if you.
So you take the tokens from the visual prompt from the image here that represent this image and
With
compare them
image.
to these tokens to the textual equivalent of the image.
But is the. I'm not familiar with the technicalities of VLMs.
A VLM,
Are they
okay,
operating as
a VLM
intended?
can also not receive any image and then it acts just like an LLM, completely normally. It doesn't have to receive an image encoding. Cool. So
Does you mentioned like do you set I'm kind of curious, does amplifying that representation do anything? Does it help?
what do you mean amplifying that
Like if
representation?
I'm working, I don't know if it's possible, like the trees,
Steer?
like yeah, steer in this case.
Interesting. Like steer from a textual representation towards a visual representation somehow.
Yeah, like the prints of the tree or
Yeah.
whatever.
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, given that this is sort of an instance of steering, right, with a specific factor, then maybe. Good question.
And if why do people think this works?
What do you mean?
Well, why like so the model obviously isn't trained to have high performance with this kind of backpatching. So why do people think that backpatching is effective?
I think that generally your representations across layers, especially like in these early tokens when you don't have any information from later on, they probably don't change very much. Like they change a lot in the last layer when the model does some sort of prediction in text, which explains this crash here. But
So
I
it
would
does,
say that between
so it doesn't change much, which is why you wouldn't expect it to be damaging. So, but why would you expect it to be helpful?
So the motivation here was just replace the visual representations with a textual equivalent, sort of.
But I think the interesting point here is that the representations do become more similar to the text ones, but it's too late for the circuit to use it. You can see it there at the top right. Like that, by the time the representations are similar enough for the language model to do anything, computation has already proceeded and attention has moved
You
stuff
don't
there.
have enough layers left
No,
to move it to later positions and
but
processes.
it's quite interesting, right? Because you would expect that this circuit that would benefit from this from the models being similar would have to be present in the gradient to give the model motivation to make them the representation similar in this way. But obviously it's not present in the gradient, right? It's not on the path at all. And so I totally buy the idea that in the abstract, the representations
Oh,
are getting
you're
more
asking
similar.
the deeper questions of why does similarity even increase over time, like
So
because there's no gradient to force it to.
there's similarity, there's general similarity, but it's dimensional space. So there's a lot of ways it could be similar. And there's a particular way that it's similar here that allows you to ask this, answer this numerical question. And then, so the puzzle is, well, why would it become similar in that way when it's too late to answer a numerical question anyway? You know, like, what's the motivation for the model to even do that?
Maybe generally, the model would want to promote any non-text modality to the same representation as full textual tokens. Not necessarily in the last layers, right? Even if it happens by this, by middle layers, then generally across prompts, not even of these specific tasks.
So the way I translate that is similarity is similarity, you know, regardless of like what the purpose of the similarity would be for, right? And it's still puzzling to me. I mean, it's still interesting. I mean, it's not too puzzling because you got it to work, and we've seen similar phenomenon before as well. Like, you know, when we patch different layers, right? You remember in your function vector paper, you were like, why are we patching to an earlier layer? Why is it performing better? And so it's not mysterious in the sense that like, oh, I understand this happens, but it's a little, I'm still mystified by why this would be the case.
When you do the backpatching, does it climb again as the model moves?
Oh, like you could backpatch twice. Now it gets more similar
Damn.
again.
We try we
to try
we
that.
we tried backpatching. We tried backpatching several times. It's a degrading performance
But
since
you
then, I guess, because of the
Oh, really?
one
No.
one just like in one of the tasks, it was
Like,
in
but you
general.
can watch twice.
Yeah,
Okay.
exactly. It yeah, the
Interesting.
looped
Interesting.
transformers. Yeah, we sort of you're yeah, that's a spoiler for one of the points now. I just wanna finish and we'll see like if we have time for a quick
You
run
can
over there.
get to
Okay,
robust
so
scale-up.
cool. So I'll go forward, and if there are questions, I'll answer in the end. So I think the implications here are, first of all, that current VLMs, as we saw, are limited in the way they combine modalities. I think it's mostly because VLM architectures today are just a form of necessity that started out because people wanted to reuse existing language decoders and existing vision encoders and not train everything from scratch. But this is inherently limited. In this context, I think what one of the findings is that maybe we need to process different modalities in a different amount. Right when we worked on this, there was a paper from UMD on like loop transformers, which in my mind related really to this. Like, just take any modality and loop different amount of times, like loop some of the net layers in the network a different amount of times to process it better. But to my point, I think the thing which I want to convince you in is that even with we didn't fully reverse engineer the circuits here. We don't know how counting works in either modality, but we were able to use insights from circuit analysis to point us towards directions of to guided directions of fixing model problems. Now I want to go over the last point rather briefly, and point that in my opinion, what's missing today in the interpretability research, one of the things, and also missing in my two show works that I've showed you, is that if we draw some plot of various tasks which models are able to solve, let's say, forget like what each axis, like forget what the y-axis means, higher means more complex. So frontier models are generally here, able to solve complex tasks taking hours even, while we in interpretability are researching somewhere around here. Single token output tasks, like toy settings, nothing extremely applicable to frontier applications. Now, I think it's is interesting to sort of scale up and try to move towards the more complex tasks and develop techniques that will allow us to do so. And this brings us to our one of our current projects, which is how to apply circuit analysis for more complex tasks. Where when I mean complex, I mean things that are tasks that are not single output token, can be couple or hundreds or even more. Cool. Tasks that are not necessarily position aligned, where we don't force all of the inputs to be exactly to contain exactly the same content in each position, and hopefully tasks which we can use real data, real world data for, and not have to redefine our own experimental data for. And specifically, one question we decided to tackle is: can we apply circuit analysis to study questions in such long form complex tasks that might actually use not one, not a single mechanism to solve, but many lower order mechanisms. And the task we chose to start with is coding, where we have some sort of definition of a function and the model is asked to implement it. And the output can be many tokens, comprised of, let's say, many different mechanisms. And we ask the question of, can we take this higher order semantic task and break it down to its components in a sort of unsupervised way? The way we do this is by first defining a set of coding prompts and finding the circuits or set of components that are important for each output position. Now, there are a lot of like technical points here which I don't go into, but let's just take it as granted. Given all of this set of many, many circuits that might or might not be related, we want to find their relatedness. We want to find their similarities. And we do this by, after generating the circuits, calculating some sort of similarity metric between each pair, very similar to the structural similarity or functional similarity, which we saw in the previous work, and try to cluster them based on these similarities. Groups of circuits with high similarities between them are clustered together, and hopefully each cluster will represent some sort of lower order semantic tasks. Now, forgive me for the poor visualization, but let's say we have some sort of cluster here where each row represents an individual circuit for a specific prompt and
But
output
maybe you
positions.
should let people stare at that. It was very fast. I
Yeah,
think it's
I won't like I'm slowly going
okay.
into it and I'll give you more time. So we basically have a circuit that corresponds to this output token and this part of this output string for I, where the I is the output token. And all of these each row, as I said, is a single circuit, and all of these circuits were clustered together in our current setup. Now, if you'll have a look at the output strings, you'll see some sort of pattern. Does anyone want to point out which pattern this is? Four loops, or specifically the, whoops.
Iterator.
Yeah, specifically the iteration constant in the for loop, like for in something. We saw like some other interesting clusters, like return values, which might be completely different, but usually come after some return statement. Simpler clusters where it's just a new line or a couple of new lines. And
Those are all new lines after a colon.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused.
huh, no. Well, some of them are not, but most of them are. Cool. New lines after a colon. Yeah, Quinn.
Sorry, can you take a, like, I mean, just in general, like, okay, yeah, maybe I should see this. Essentially, I was trying to understand how you got the table to begin with.
Right, so we found for each output position in each prompt, we have like hundreds of prompts, hundreds of output positions in each such prompt. We search for a set of components that are sufficient to generate this output, sufficient being high faithfulness. Again, won't go into this too much. Afterwards, we define a similarity measure, which we're not sure on how to define properly yet. And is very important. We define a similarity measure between every pair of circuits, like every pair of sets. And you can think about a big graph, like a big, just a big, not computational graph, but just a big graph where the nodes are, each node is a circuit, and the edge between every two nodes is the weight of it, is the similarity between them. And then we want to cluster this meta graph to find clusters within it which have high similarity between them, like this part and this part. I didn't draw the edges, but you can imagine there is an edge between every two pairs.
I think this is where we would appreciate as much feedback as possible. So this is like our
This is a
current.
general
So you're making a
template, yeah.
circuit from a single prompt, is that right?
Yes. I
Kind of like
mean,
the way the Anthropic does these things, right? So like, because like in your previous analysis, you made a circuit, whatever, you had a whole
a whole
distribution,
set,
a whole
exactly.
distribution. And now you're like, okay.
Now I want to find the distribution. That's
Let's put that aside.
the
We'll
point.
take a single prompt and we'll use that single sample. And then we'll try to see. I see. And then when you cluster them, are you looking for similar components or something? That's what you're doing.
Right now, yes.
But there could be multiple components that could be similar in the cluster. Is it supposed to be like just one thing that's
No, I'm basically right now the similarity measure is an overlap, just as we saw before,
That's it.
which it's not good enough.
You can say the concrete, each of these steps has some concrete implementation that you tried. You
Yes,
can say the
exactly.
people can
Okay,
implement.
so step one, you collect free form, long form. So human eval, you just go over all of human eval, you get it. So that's like a
And
code, a
fill
code,
and filter out good
like a
completion.
code L, a simple code LM. And then
Step two, what do you
step
do?
two, yeah, which circuit method do you use?
So right now it's attribution graphs, like the sparse attribution graphs that Anthropic worked on.
How Michael Hann is working.
Exactly.
So you just
It
use
has
his,
many downsides,
so you
and
literally use his code to describe whatever.
Michael's code is usually wonderful,
But there
I
is a major
recommend.
problem. You should talk about
Yeah, the problem there is that the code doesn't well, their work on attention, on like adding attention heads to the computational graphs, isn't really published well, and
which is
it
to say
doesn't
you
have an
cannot
implementation.
understand
Yeah,
the
you can
meaning of the
understand the
wrong code.
implementation. Michael is attempting to implement it now, but he's having also a lot of headaches with it.
There are no position. There's no position information.
That's another problem.
Oh, what do you mean?
Wait, that's a different
Oh,
problem.
okay. That's a
Yeah,
different.
the attribution graphs indeed contain position information. I just drop it because the positions here are misaligned between prompts. Position two,
Well, you
position
don't have you. Well, you
21,
don't know the semantics, right? Right.
position two, I don't want to assume anything about the positions, which is
Okay.
a limitation, but
Okay.
somehow need to
So,
circumvent
oh,
it.
but that might be a big
A big problem.
problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're
So
disregarding that.
this is like positionless information. All the
Yeah.
position information is dropped. And there are no edges between
No, I there are
position,
it. Okay, there
between
are in it.
positions.
No, there
There are no
aren't it.
edges between position.
Right.
Yeah.
I just have a small note. So the main circuit is based on a single problem, and the components of it are those sub problems you're trying to solve for that single problem or
So, well, what we have is basically the single problem of, let's say, coding.
okay.
Many prompts that are unaligned, unrelated at any point except for being all coding.
Okay.
And we're trying to ask if we can take this higher order task. Coding is just an example. We'll
Okay.
also try other things
Okay.
and deconstruct it to as many mechanisms as possible, which are shared across different instances of the coding problem. It's merely a, I think this is a single question we ask. I mean, I guess there are also other many possible questions to ask
I love this exercise that you're
on this
doing. It's such a
complex.
fun. So yeah, I have an opinion, but I have no idea if this opinion maps onto something, right, that is actionable to you, right? Which is, and so you can see from the style of research that we generally do in the lab that we generally don't spend a lot of time chasing the circuits all the way from beginning to end. And that's probably because of my own opinion. Like, I don't push the students to do that. And which is that probably when you look at these broad distributions like this, like real data, probably what's important is certain bottlenecks in the computation, certain neural representations at certain points, right? Where the computation gets to a certain point, and then the model has to figure out some abstraction, some invariant.
Are you talking about a single forward pass or also a many?
In a single, so what do you mean?
Like the bottleneck issue you're describing, you're referring in a single forward pass or the
No,
bottleneck?
across a distribution.
Okay.
So like you have many things, right? And then so like when you use your artificial distributions and you say, oh, here at this moment, we have the concept of a number of bananas or something like that, right? You know, the reason that you can identify a circuit is because there's actually a series of bottlenecks for some set of text. But I'd assume that if you had pretty different text, then you might have a subset of those bottlenecks. Like that different text might join in with that circuit at a different moment, and so the sort of my mental picture is that you have interesting moments where at approximately certain layer ranges you have a type of information that's being represented, and then the circuits are really just little pathways of getting from one of these abstractions to the next in certain contexts, right? And so as you go and you mine all these circuits, then I imagine that an exercise would almost be like the circuit's almost too big, right? The circuit is actually made up of lots of little pathways going from one interesting bottleneck to the interesting next interesting bottleneck to the in next interesting bottleneck, and so on. And so you're sort of clustering together whole circuits, which is interesting, but maybe, I'm not sure if that's too specific or if it's too, like I'm not sure what, right? Like I imagine that what you might want to do is if you have lots of circuits, you're sort of looking for almost like where do they cross in the middle? Right. And then, where is a natural place to split them? And that kind of
Think this
thing.
makes
You know what I mean?
like the interesting thing here is to do some bottom up completely unsupervised, the data-driven approach to discovery without imposing distributions.
Right.
But the trouble here is that so far we're seeing the shared things among the many different circuits are just very shallow features that are not so interesting, these token detectors.
Right.
And so we are thinking, what is the right abstraction? And maybe the full circuits are not the right abstraction because their shared stuff is
Too
too
specific.
it's too shallow, because what would happen everywhere? Well, new line happens everywhere. But the question is how to get at those bottlenecks or right abstractions without bringing in your knowledge about the domain. Because we could do in code, you could do a lot of things because
I
you
know,
know
I
how to
know.
abstract.
We do, right? So
But we're
so
trying to avoid it,
no,
like
I know.
kind of resisting the temptation to go
Well,
there.
we tried to. It didn't help much.
No, but
Like.
I love this. And if right, and so and so like Arnab is about, so we're starting to push Arnab in the code direction. And so he has like some interesting sort of neural concepts in code that he's gonna try to chase.
You
And
can do a
I
lot of things if you look at the structure of the code,
don't, right,
which is
right.
we might still
You
do,
might still do, right? So
but we're
that's,
trying to kind of
but
see
this
if
is
you can do without.
an opportunity to do something else,
Yeah.
right? Is which I like. Is great.
In
Yes.
this context of your comment, by the way, we try
Yes.
to remove some parts which we deemed uninteresting, which dominated the similarities. For example, in the same prompt, in all positions, you have the same input, right? A lot of shared input, the same function definition, and you need a lot of shared features between those prompts to analyze that input. So this indicates that between different output positions in the same prompt, by definition, there will be a much higher similarity in their circuits, like because their input processing components are the same. So maybe this, like we try to remove these. And also output generation components. We don't really care about the features that are responsible for literally generating the answer, because then all of the clusters will just be the same token, an extremely shallow behavior. We started like we're experiment we experimented with this, but maybe like more work, probably more work is there that's needed.
I know you're talking about like shallow behavior, but what if you were to combine all these shallow behaviors because you're doing all these different clusters that it actually may talk about like a con like code concept that is required to use all of these shallow
What do you
behaviors?
mean?
Like let's say for I guess the incrementalist part, like yes, maybe you need new lines, maybe you do need iterators, but like maybe there's some other concept. Other cluster as well, along with which all of them is actually useful for incrementing, like basically like a
Yeah,
code.
you could do. So the clustering is vertical.
Yeah.
It's a community detection
Yeah.
thing, but you could look. So each cluster is a community, but if you could look at how they combine, and look at different levels in the hierarchy. So you take a cluster of
Oh, yeah, right.
iterator plus a cluster of, I don't know, colon,
Yeah.
open paren, something, and together they may form something.
Yeah.
Oh, that's also
Like a
interesting.
meta cluster.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that, and I guess the second question, I wasn't sure, like,
It's down in the wow, yeah.
are these circuits that you're forming off of one model or like across
No, all of these are in a single model.
in the same?
Otherwise, your components are different and you
Yeah.
need to do different things.
Yeah, I guess because it was already not positionless, I was like, oh, is it?
So, have you done a lit review to see how much previous work there has been done on direct analysis of representations in these code LMs already, like previous existing work?
Code LMs, no, because coding is just it's sort of a validation. Right now, it's not our goal,
Okay. Okay.
but
There's been a lot
Yeah. And so
in
like
code
so like a
behaviors.
general thing would be like, for like, if Francesca has a paper saying, oh, we've found an interesting representation or an interesting circuit for identifying types, like type declarations or type representations or something like that, which is what she was studying. Then a reasonable question would be like, oh, somebody already found something in code LMs. When I do my clusters, is one of the clusters that Does it show up, or is what I'm doing not compatible with what previous? Because like I think this is like a reasonable thing to do, and if other people have published
It's
things,
a validation question, Josh, right?
right.
We want our current step is to replace the task to a more to one that's more easy to validate and which we know where which sort of which mechanisms would we expect to find there.
Oh, well, I guess what you, I mean, so
So maybe instead of finding.
I like the fact that you're clustering unsupervised, is finding these things. But then I think that right now you're in this tea leaf reading situation that a lot of people in the interpretability world have found themselves in, which is always dissatisfying, right? Where
You're
you
searching
have,
for a behavior that you don't know if it
well,
exists.
yeah, you have 1,000 clusters. And you look through the clusters and, oh, ten, out of the 1,000, 10 of them look pretty interesting. And then you can like show these 10 and have an interesting story. And right. And then people are like, okay, well, I'm not sure if you find, right. So it's like a Rorschach blob test, right? One of these, right. It's like, do you see meaning in here or not? Right. And people are wondering if your experimental results have to do with your experiment or if it has to do with your own mind, right. So the question. And so, but a natural way to check that is to say, well, there are things that other people have found in these models, and when we do this
We're fine.
sweep, they
Yeah,
get picked up,
I
right?
get that.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Just so
right, that's one of my to-dos for this week is like think about which of these tasks we can put into and we can like definitely talk about it.
David, what you said something about in those circuits, look for the cross-cutting parts. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I just don't know. It's just a general. It's my general unease about the whole circuit paradigm, which is that, this. So I think that there's this. You guys are directly attacking it, right? Where when you move to just the general text setting. And you have two different pieces of text that are sort of reasoning about similar things, but expressing them with a different word order or a different syntax, you get these very different, you'll get these very different circuits. And does it really mean that they're so different? And I guess what I imagine is that you can find the similarities, maybe not by looking at the whole circuit, but by looking at which bottlenecks or something the circuit's going to. So, for example, like what? So, like, if I'm just
The
sort of,
question is how to identify
how do you
them.
identify them, right? So, yes. So, yeah, I think it's a reasonable.
And maybe one way, now we're conflating all the token position. Maybe a way would be to identify certain token positions that are important and let them define the circuit and then compute these similarities.
Right.
Maybe.
It could be token position, attention head, set pairs or something like that. So you have these circuits that are made of all these attention heads that are reading from all these different token positions. And maybe that's the thing to cluster, is that you have these interesting read operations that are happening across all your circuits and you
That's
cluster.
another question on how to combine the attention head and information flow information on this. I'm having a talk with someone from BU on this like
Good.
next week. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So that seems promising, right? That kind
Yeah,
of thing.
I think there are enough like directions to attack this problem to try and get better results or.
Sorry, to talk about step three, how are you exactly finding similarity in?
Right now, it's just overlap, like component overlap.
IOU.
IOU, yeah.
Yeah, like, have you considered using a representation similarity?
Yes,
Is it?
that is, well, we tried that in the previous work. There, it was extremely computationally difficult because it just requires an well, basically, if I remember correctly, we didn't try it here because from two circuits comparison, here you have many more. But because this can be done like statically, maybe that's a direction to go to. I think personally I've been a bit burned with representation comparisons because, well, because there are it's not, well, there are various problems with that. But like it is an open question of maybe we should go that way and try it again.
Do you have also slides about your other project or no?
The reasoning one, no. But I can summarize and let people go, and then if anyone will want to talk more, I'd be more than happy to.
Think people who are interested
Yeah, so I'll say this.
reasoning and
Yeah, so
we can maybe like maybe.
okay, so yeah, so I'll just finish this and say a word about that. I think our current sort of set of results can indicate that we might have some direction of attacking this problem, despite the results being rather shallow so far. There are enough moving parts here that can be altered to, as we said, attack the problem. Also, the ones you suggested here, which I wrote some away. Yeah, I think, as I said before, we can both of these works and like both the completed works, the work in progress that I talked about, and a couple of others where we discuss where we try to investigate behaviors from a circuit perspective in protein language models led by one of our master's students, and another project which I'm working on in like reasoning, trying to use input attributions and not component attributions to show that you can prune, like to show various interesting conclusions on chains of thought, mainly that you can prune most of a chain of thought and still get a s high sufficiency to generate the answer, sort of directing at maybe actual applications of attributions to like of
You should give it the say
what?
the hypothesis of what we want to call this.
A friend of Jonathan suggested to call the reasoning lottery ticket hypothesis, similar to the lottery ticket hypothesis, which like basically in our setting states that you can just not randomly, but pick a specific subset of a chain of thought, and it will be, even if it's not coherent, it's good enough for the model to generate the correct answer on its own. Sort of related to, well, I sort of thought it's related to your work on the generality. I'd love to talk more about that. And this like set of works was done with this amazing group of people. And that's it. If any of the things I mentioned, either on completed projects, works in progress, or just general thoughts on complex tasks, reasoning, biology, whatever seem interesting to you, I'd love to talk. And that's it.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. Really, really great work.
Stop sharing.